Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, May 13th. I want to start today with a contrast between Wuhan and the White House. I know we've been tough on President Trump here at the top of the show the last few days, but the news from Wuhan today makes such a contrast with Monday's White House press briefing on the issue of testing. We have to call things like this out if we're ever going to be ready to test and contact trace enough in this country to actually reopen the economy, which, of course, the president desperately wants to do for his reelection and which we all want to do for our lives. And we have New York and California examples today of how hard that's going to be, Trump or no Trump. New York City announced yesterday that Broadway theaters, dark since March, will now officially remain closed through at least September 6th. That's Labor Day weekend. So Broadway had already lost the spring. Now it's lost the summer. And the California State University system announced yesterday that it will have no in-person classes in the fall statewide. That's 23 campuses around the state, nearly 500,000 students, online learning only through Christmas in all of California in the state university system. That doesn't mean every other college in America will do that. Many of you are waiting to hear about your schools, I know, but the whole Cal State system, that's a blow. And that's in California, where they've done a good job on containing the virus compared to some of the East Coast states. So what do Broadway and the Cal States have to do with Wuhan and the White House? Here's what. Wuhan, the place with the original outbreak, right, had gotten cases down to zero, or so China claims, but they said zero cases there for more than a month. In the last few days, though, they had a new small outbreak, apparently coming from some people who had arrived infected from Russia. And according to the news this morning, Wuhan is about to test all 11 million people in that city. All 11 million people. And they'll quarantine anyone who's positive. That's testing and tracing to contain an outbreak rather than let it get out of hand. At the White House, they had this event on Monday with a big sign. Did you see it? That says, America leads the world in testing. But actually, we're not number one in testing per capita, according to the OECD. We're number 22. No one's making t-shirts that say, we're number 22. We're behind other countries with big outbreaks, too, like Spain and Italy. And we're behind 19 other countries. And here's the end of the contrast. With a new outbreak in Wuhan, and so they don't have to shut down the whole economy again and make everyone stay home again, they're going to test all 11 million residents. Well, here's what President Trump said on Monday about who should get tested when there are new outbreaks in this country.
If people want to get tested, they get tested. But for the most part, they shouldn't want to get tested. There's no reason. They feel good. They don't have sniffles. They don't have sore throats. They don't have any problem.
You shouldn't want to get tested if you feel good? Wrong. When we're ready to contain the virus, so many people who feel good will have to get tested because there are so many asymptomatic cases. And not just once. Here's how the president downplayed the fact that Vice President Pence's press secretary, Katie Miller, got the virus.
One person tested positive, surprisingly, because the previous day tested negative.
Surprisingly, because the previous day tested negative. Wrong. It's not surprising to be negative one day and positive the next. That's true of everyone who gets the virus. You're negative one day and you're positive the next. And it's why testing has to be at intervals, depending on the situation, if you're really going to protect group workplaces and houses of worship and other places where people gather. And so one last clip. Trump's testing czar, Admiral Brett Giroir, at the Monday briefing. Do you know how often he gets tested to protect the president? He gets tested constantly.
people who come into close contact with the president get tested on a regular basis, okay? If I were not in close contact with the president specifically, I would not get tested, like most people here do not get tested. That's a very specific circumstance. When I work at HHS, I go at HHS, I don't get tested. I do the exact thing that we ask Americans to do, to monitor your symptoms. If you are symptomatic, self-isolate, get tested.
So the question also becomes one of royalty, seems to me. Why is the president's life more valuable than yours, or your parents, or your coworkers, or your fellow students who want to return to Cal State and not stay home and learn on Zoom? Wuhan is testing everybody to isolate the new outbreak. The admiral gets tested, I think it's every day, to protect the president. It's not every day, it's close. The president says you should only get tested if you have sniffles. The contrast is stark, and it adds up to minimizing and evading by the president. And the sign is a lie. America does not lead the world in testing in the ways that matter most. And this issue really matters. With me now on that and more, Mary Bassett, director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University, and she's a public health professor at Harvard. And before she left New York for Harvard, she was Mayor de Blasio's original health commissioner for 4 years. Dr. Bassett, always good to have you on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks very much, Brian. Good to talk with you.
What do you think of the story from Wuhan? Test and trace the whole city to contain a new outbreak. Is that the ideal when there's an outbreak?
Well, I don't know the exact number of cases that they've seen or how widespread they are. But the idea of contact tracing is that you can stop that spark that will start a chain of transmission. And the hope is that when you take such dramatic actions as telling everybody to stay at home and closing down the economy, that you reduce the number of new cases to a level where you can track each one of those little sparks. So whole population testing for a cluster may not be necessary. If you think of it like a spark that you stamp out with your foot, as opposed to a blaze in a fireplace where you wouldn't consider going after it with your feet, that's what's happening in many, many places, including New York City, including Massachusetts. But the hope is that we can get it down and that contact tracing can be limited to cluster investigations. But, you know, ideally, we would all know our status. If the testing capacity is there in Wuhan, makes sense to do it. What the president doesn't seem to understand is that there is asymptomatic infection, people who feel entirely well, as well as people who are feeling well and haven't yet begun to show symptoms. You can't find that without a test.
Some places in the U.S. with small numbers of cases say they can test and trace now as they cautiously reopen, that there are enough tests in some places. What would it take for Broadway or the California State University system, to use the examples from the news of the last day, to reopen safely?
I don't think Harvard has made a decision yet, but the faculty is certainly expecting that there will be continued remote instruction. You know, we're still learning a lot about this virus, and the idea that you can test to make sure that somebody is safe makes me a little nervous. We don't know how long someone's infected and may be infectious and doesn't yet test positive. So that's why contact tracing is based on exposure, not just on tests. And people are asked to quarantine themselves based on exposure. So the idea that you could line up everybody before they go into a Broadway show and test them and that would be safe doesn't seem reasonable to me. More reasonable is the idea of trying to space people widely apart, but for some things that just doesn't make sense. So I understand the decision that was made in New York, hard as it is. Plus, the number of cases may still be substantial come the fall.
And yes,
and they may be going up.
You teach at Harvard, but I know you care deeply about public colleges and universities from your days here, like SUNY and CUNY and Cal State as well, and to the frame of your position there at Harvard as director for the Center for Health and Human Rights. Do you see a disparate impact on higher education from the virus and perhaps from the government's response? The financial impact alone on public colleges is just starting to emerge.
Well, you know, the resource that the public education system at all levels has for our society is not sufficiently acknowledged and not sufficiently supported. Even a very rich university like Harvard is saying that it's going to be facing substantial economic constraints related to COVID. So the public university system definitely has to be protected with public funds.
And listeners,
it's investing in the future. And the students, of course, you know, are not the wealthy students that attend the elite universities.
And that's one of the biggest reasons for the push by states and cities to get federal aid specifically for states and cities. It's because of the state university systems and other public colleges and universities as much as any other aspect. I don't think that gets enough publicity, but that's for another segment. Let me get to some New York City issues for you as the former health commissioner. I saw you criticized Mayor de Blasio last week for planning to use the public hospital system rather than the health department to set up the huge contact tracing program for here, since I'm in New York. I assume this isn't just about turf because you used to be the health commissioner.
Well, first let me say that it's really important to get contact tracing in place. And contact tracing is not a be-all and end-all. It's part of a whole package, as you've been discussing. You find people who test positive. You take care of them, meaning they get them clinical care if they're sick. You isolate them if you find their contacts, and you quarantine them to ensure that they don't develop sickness. So it's really it's testing, quarantine, isolation, and looking after people the whole way. Now, so it's really important to have that, and that's the main thing. But there is a long, long history. I haven't looked it up, but it's decades or more of health departments doing this. I witnessed the health department in Ebola set up a call center that, you know, followed thousands of people who were returning from the affected countries in West Africa. So deep expertise resides in the health department. It makes sense to me to build on that expertise, and I'm sorry that the health department is not in the lead, but I am glad that contact tracing will be underway in New York.
I see you also wrote an article in Foreign Affairs magazine about policing being the wrong tactic for a disease that preys on inequality. Let me set this up for our listeners by reading some stats from Gothamist that people may have heard or may not have heard about what's been happening in New York. More than 90% of those arrested for violating social distancing rules in New York City during the first 6 weeks of the pandemic were Black or Hispanic, according to leaked data that the mayor's office and the NYPD have declined to release, despite promises to make it publicly available. Here are those stats reported by CBS2. Police issued 368 summonses and arrested 120 people for social distancing offenses between March 16th and May 5th. Black New Yorkers, who make up a quarter of the city's population, accounted for more than two-thirds of those arrested. 24% of those arrested were Hispanic. White people made up just 7% of all arrests. And Gothamist continues, the stark disparities were also evident in an analysis released on Friday by the Brooklyn District Attorney's Office, which found that 39 of 40 people arrested in the borough for social distancing violations were people of color. So with that as prelude, Dr. Bassett, want to talk about your article?
Sure. So this pattern of racial disparities in police enforcement of social distancing is occurring across the country. We don't have good data. A lot of the experience of this is coming through social media and vignettes, you know, teenagers in Walmart in Illinois who were arrested for wearing their masks, a physician in Miami who was handcuffed outside of his home for when he was loading up materials to help the homeless. As a woman, and most of the people who have experienced this have been men of color, but a woman in San Diego without just walking her dog. So those are the sort of vignettes that come from social media, and they support what data we have, the data that you've just listed from New York, also in Ohio, data from Cincinnati, Cleveland, Toledo, also show something like a fourfold more likely to have a charge for violating a social distancing thing if you're Black. So this also, though, feeds into the question of how should we be doing this? What happens when you turn the enforcement of a public health measure over to police? Well, part of it is the very tainted and stressed relations between communities of colors and police forces. And the other part of it, though, is that the public has to embrace these measures. The idea of criminalizing something that we need people to do every day, in their home, out of their home, because they have to do it because they understand that they're protecting themselves, their families, and their communities, not because they think that they might be arrested or worse. So this concept of using the police to enforce public health measures is very worrying to me.
I asked the mayor about this on Friday on the show, and he justified using the police in part like this.
The NYPD is in every neighborhood, deeply connected and knowledgeable about neighborhood, deep relationships all around, in a way that there's no parallel in other agencies of that kind of reach and that ability to be present and effective. And again, the vast majority of what the NYPD does is both effective in terms of protecting safety and more community-focused and engaged with communities.
What about that argument, Dr. Bassett, that no other force is big enough and has the relationships? He's characterizing the police not in terms of guns and batons, but relationships that other agencies don't have.
Yeah, well, that sounds very nice. But then we have these images that resonate also with the data that show long histories of unequal enforcement, of over-aggressive policing, of continued racial patterning of police killings, including, across the United States and including New York City, that mean that Black men, young Black men, are severalfold more likely to die at the hands of police. So this is part of the community experience as well. I'm not sure if you asked residents that they would share that view. And the notion that it's a few bad apples is really belied by the persistence and consistency of these observations. I'm really getting worried when, police start calling. I don't know if this has happened in New York, but in other places, they're setting up hotlines for citizens to turn in people to the police for violating social distancing. You can see how this could rapidly get out of hand. And I come back to the fact that the way this COVID pandemic will be controlled is through people. People are going to have to understand and embrace the very hard road that lies ahead because they know it's to protect themselves and their families. And that's not achieved by fear, threats, punishment, and even bodily harm.
In addition to the question of policing, for you as director of a Center for Health and Human Rights, we've seen the dramatic disparities that I think everybody is pretty familiar with by now in who's getting sick and dying from the virus. And we know a lot of that comes from longstanding structural racism that leads to those disparate vulnerabilities by group in the first place. And then we also see things like the Ahmaud Arbery killing in the news on top of it. Are there metrics through which the data-oriented public health profession looks at racism as a public health issue?
Well, the first thing is to have data that can be broken down by race. And as you know, these data are not widely available. And many states have huge amounts of missing data on race variables. Massachusetts, where I'm now, has over 50% of deaths don't have race data available. So the first step always to understanding a problem is to have the data to assess it. But even with the really incomplete data, it's consistent that both Black and Latinos are more likely to get infected, because in order to die of COVID, you first have to get it, and then more likely to die of it. I really wish people would talk more about what being an essential worker has meant to the risk of COVID, because many people in low-wage jobs are classified as essential, and many of them are going to work every day and have been. They're in the warehouses. They're in, you know, delivering our mail and other goods. They're stocking the grocery store shelves and at the checkout counter. And these are all people who don't earn much money and have been out there and at higher risk and more likely to be Black and Latino.
Right. And so if you look then at what's needed for the public health response to the pandemic through a social justice lens, including who the essential workers are, what needs to be done today?
Oh, they need to be offered the same kind of protections that we would offer the people that everyone views as our heroes, first responders and the healthcare workers. They need to be viewed just as much as our heroes. Someone like me who gets to work remotely can only do that because essential workers are keeping things going that let me stay at home. So that means having personal protective equipment. It means having paid sick leave, because if you're an hourly worker, that hour you don't work, you don't get paid. It means having health insurance so that when you get sick, you don't worry about hidden bills everybody worries about, because many people are underinsured. And of course, if you have no health insurance. And another part of it, I think, has to be acknowledging that people should not be doing this work for poverty wages that don't allow them to even earn a living. And there needs to be hazard pay. And people who have personal risks because of their own health conditions can't be put in the terrible position of having to take a chance that they know may kill them because they have to earn a living. They need to get special dispensation. Same thing if you are in a multi-generational household, right? Because many immigrant and low-income families, you know, have elders living in the household too. And the stuff that makes me most sad when I think about EMT drivers going home and saying how terrified they are to bring COVID home. So people need to have the right to alternate housing. And all these sorts of things are being done for health workers. It's possible. All those empty hotels, those empty college dorms, it's possible. This is a really rich country. And New York City is a very rich city with a lot of poor people who are still scraping to get by.
You've given a lot of people, a lot to think about. So we're going to leave it there. Dr. Mary Bassett, former New York City Health Commissioner, now director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is obviously also a Daily Coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.